From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in large part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
What kind of a radical revolutionary this man was. What a threat to the social and political and religious order he was.
Reza Aslan is a popular commentator, best-selling writer, university professor, and the author of the brand new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. His exploration of ancient texts and the historical context of the stories told in the New Testament offer a fascinating new look at a figure revered by billions of people worldwide. And Reza Aslan will be with us on this edition of State of Belief Radio.
The verdict is in, and George Zimmerman has been found not guilty on all counts.
New York and other cities across the country, protesters voiced their frustrations.
I think that if Trayvon had been white, this wouldn't have never happened.
Just over a week ago in Florida, the jury in the murder trial of George Zimmerman handed down a not guilty verdict. The case has been a catalyst for many heated discussions on race and justice in this country. A little later on this week's show, I'll be joined by the Reverend Michael McBride, who's been deeply involved in this work as director of the PICO National Network's Lifelines to Healing campaign. But first,
let's stand our ground. This is our ground. This is sacred ground. This is justice ground. This is freedom's ground. Sometimes we do get discouraged. But then the Holy Spirit comes. Then we get around each other. And it revives our soul again. We stand on our ground.
2 weeks ago on this program, you heard from the Reverend Jill Edens, who spoke passionately about her participation in the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina. You'll remember her talking about the Reverend William Barber. Reverend Barber is the head of the North Carolina NAACP and a leading voice for justice, not just in his state, but nationwide. And so it should come as no surprise that he has also been playing a leading role in the response to the Trayvon Martin case. And I am very pleased to be able to welcome the Reverend William Barber to State of Belief Radio. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you and with your listening audience.
Start by talking about your own personal reaction to the not guilty verdict for George Zimmerman and how then you connect that to the other issues that you're addressing in the ongoing Moral Mondays protest in North Carolina.
Well, I think that you have to first look at the so-called stand your ground laws as a deep problem in this country, because we already have laws for self-defense. Stand your ground laws just add to the ability to perpetrate violence. And we often see that the license to kill is being used in a more racialized way, if you will. 58 years ago, a young man went to the store to buy candy, and he ended up dead. His name was Emmett Till. Then in Sanford, young boy goes to the store to get candy, and he winds up killed.
Mm.
And the killer says that it was self-defense, but he stalked him. He profiled him. You have him on tape profiling him using expletives to profile Trayvon. And if you use the logic that the jury used to make this decision, it would mean that if Emmett Till had fought back against his perpetrator, the people who abducted him, they could have argued that they killed him in self-defense. And that's dangerous for not just black kids, but all kids. That means if a white kid goes in a community that happens to be predominantly black and somebody profiles him and says he looks suspicious, tracks him, stalks him, tempts him into an argument, and then kills him, they can claim that they did it in self-defense.
Reverend Barber, you left the National NAACP Conference to return to North Carolina when this verdict was read. And you were quoted as saying, "Let's stand our ground."
Well, I left because I have three sons. When I heard about that morning, I looked over at one of my sons was with me. Another one was at a church conference there, and I immediately became very hurt, very angry, very discouraged. My sons are both big sons, strong, tall, but they're boys. Mm-hmm. And I felt a sense of helplessness, a sense of hurt, a sense of anger. I cried about it, and I saw my son cry when Huckabee on the Fox News said, in essence, that if Trayvon had been more respectful and had respected Zimmerman, he wouldn't be dead. So he said Trayvon was not a hero because he should have been more respectful. Mm. I needed to be back at Mall Monday because I needed to see a community of people, black and white, Latino, who still believe in humanity. I really came back for my own healing. And I testified, and in the midst of speaking to them, I said, we need to stand our ground on things like repealing stand your ground laws. We need to stand our ground against violence. We need to stand our ground and push for laws that outlaw racial profiling. We need to stand our ground against all forms of violence. You know, as Coretta Scott King said, keeping children in poverty is a form of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Producing more guns is a form of violence. Taking kids' education, healthcare is a form of violence. We need to stand our ground and believe in a humanity and the possibility of humanity to be different than what is being portrayed by these folk that are so afraid of something that all they can think of is their answer to every problem is cut taxes, make the poor more responsible, and give people more guns.
Right.
We need to stand our ground against that kind of philosophy.
So when you talk with your colleagues, what do you want to call for where you live and beyond?
We must stop this proliferation of guns. We've gone gun crazy. Our legislature in North Carolina, this is what they've decided to do, for instance, at our state capitol. Denied 500,000 people access to Medicaid, poor people, poor children. 170,000 people unemployment. They've kicked 30,000 kids off of preschool, poor kids. Raised taxes on 900,000 poor people to give 23 families a tax break. Attack voting rights, and then pass bills to put more guns in the street, allow guns in places where there's liquor being served, to allow guns on college campuses. So they've gone gun crazy. It's almost like on Star Trek, we're in some kind of extremist war, an alternative universe that doesn't even line up with our deepest moral values and our deepest constitutional values. So what I want to see is us be a catalyst for a new moral conversation. Not liberal versus conservative, not Republican versus Democrat, but what is immoral versus what is moral, what is extreme versus what is constitutional. A conversation about our common humanity, a conversation about the common good. And in that conversation, we say we're not going to commit attention violence against the poor. We're not going to pass laws to promote policies that hurt and damage the least among us. We're not going to promote policies that actually promote violence as the answer to everything, and particularly the guns. We want to roll back the access to assault weapons. We want to repeal these stand-your-ground laws in North Carolina and everywhere else, and we want to pass laws that end racial profiling. We've got to come back to our senses. I think too many people have become drunk on this Tea Party tea.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to come back to our senses in this country, particularly down in the South.
How can we change mindset so that the majority of Americans have some basic sensitivity to what life is like in this country for people who aren't like them?
Well, you need a long-term, I believe, consistent moral movement like we're seeing happening in North Carolina that shapes people's consciousness and calls people together in new ways. The NAACP in the South was often an organization that many, many white people were taught to hate and fear. And yet every Monday, under the banner of the NAACP, if you have 5,000 people there, 50% of them are white. When I came back last week, the white women in the audience had Trayvon Martin stickers on.
Hmm.
The white women in the South now. When I went to the NAACP, my general minister and president, Sharon Watkins, came over to the NAACP convention, because we were in the same building, and announced that the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is predominantly white, 95% white, was passing a emergency resolution to stand with the NAACP to call for a civil rights investigation of the Zimmerman verdict.
Boy.
So when we come together and we destroy the white Southern strategy myth, and that is that you can somehow hurt other people without hurting yourselves, and we go directly at that with a movement that's not so much, as I said, Democrat or Republican, but calls people to a higher place, calls people to the, as Abraham Lincoln said, to our better angels, then that's where you begin to find hope. When last Monday, a white lady from Harnett County, you got to understand, Harnett County is where the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan used to live. And she came up to me and said, Reverend Barbara, I was taught not to like, you know, the NAACP and such and such, but the only people fighting for us poor people right now is the NAACP. And then she said this. She said, I brought 5 other members of my family, and we're all going to jail to civil disobedience. We've never done this in our lives. She said, but I'm so sick of people tearing us apart and dividing us. We're in this together.
Mm.
I had 2 agnostics come to the back of the stage and ask me for prayer. Now, that was real interesting. And one of them said, you know, I was an agnostic, but I never heard these scriptures. See, they never heard Isaiah 10, woe unto those who legislate evil,
right,
or Luke 4, or Matthew 25, really lifted up in the circles that they've been in.
Right.
And they actually said to me, would you pray for me? And we're standing with you. And thanks for helping us rethink the whole piece about faith and about justice.
Yeah. I read the experience of Otis Moss III in Chicago. He said his son asked him, will I be next?
You answer it by holding them tight. You answer it by continuing to fight against the injustices. You answer it by making sure they go around some people who do not look like them necessarily, but also who do not think about them in terms of a threat and a thug and something to be feared.
Mm-hmm.
I went back because I needed saving again on Monday. That verdict made me so afraid and so hurt and so angry that the thought ran across my mind, you know, about arming myself, you know, those kinds of things,
right,
and thinking about it in a much, and it was a moment that I felt hate that I didn't want to feel. And I know that the only thing that can save you from that sometimes is to go around a group of people that have not lost their sense of humanity to this vicious cycle of hate.
The Reverend William Barber is the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP, the second largest in the nation. He's emerged as a leading voice for justice, as organizer of the Moral Mondays direct action movement in his state. We got him right off of a plane ride, and I'm particularly grateful that he was able to spend a few minutes with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, God bless you, and thank you and your audience, and let us never forget Isaiah 58 that says, if we cry loud and stand not against forms of injustice and violence, that one day God will call us repairers of the breach, that it should be our mission in life. And let us, as Christians, never forget that we have been anointed for such a time as this to declare good news to the poor and hope and healing to the brokenhearted. And we must take up that mantle and trust that God will take our feeble efforts when we walk by faith to do powerful things in the earth that we live.
Still to come on this week's show, Reza Aslan is back. We'll be talking about his new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. There have been many voices raised in response to the George Zimmerman verdict in Florida, and to a degree, what you hear depends on where you look. Outrageously racist comments on Twitter and elsewhere in social media lay bare the myth that we are living in a post-racial society. There have been marches in numerous cities and protests and calls for the Justice Department to actively step in. the Reverend Mike McBride, director of the PICO National Network's Lifelines to Healing campaign, organizing a meaningful and responsible response to the Trayvon Martin case. Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend. It's great to be here with you.
What are you and PICO doing to help people handle this verdict?
We will continue to organize people of faith all across this country to realize our values and to realize our calling to make and create peaceful cities and communities where our families and our young people can thrive. So we have made a particular effort to gather hundreds of clergy. We've had several calls over the last week or so, and we had over 300 clergy from across the country get on these calls, all thinking together, praying together, planning our sermons and our services for the following Sunday. So we believe that it's our responsibility to make sure that we have a very powerful faith response that is consistent, that is healing our communities, that is empowering our people, and that is speaking prophetically and powerfully to all of the institutions and the powers of our country, that all lives must be valued, particularly the lives of our young black and brown men in our community. If we don't value their lives, then I think it is a very powerful critique on our own national morality. And this is the message that we will carry and we will continue to carry.
If I were on one of your calls and I said, will you just explicitly tell me what is the role for faith leaders in this situation? How do you answer that question?
I believe the role of faith leaders in this situation, first and foremost, is to declare and remind us all, what does God have to say? What do the best of our faith traditions, our sacred texts, the practices of our faith, how do they call us forward into our best selves? Now, you will have found on this call that I'm referring to, there were clergy who were speechless, stunned, deeply hurt. There were clergy who actually felt like they could not disagree with the verdict because of the inadequacy of the prosecution. There were clergy who felt like the verdict was justified, but it was not a moral verdict. So there was a very great amount of diversity of opinion on the call, but what was unified was the deep pain that our communities continue to feel. And quite frankly, it is a pain that not many people in our country seem to respond to with a sense of urgency. So I think the role of the clergy, the role of the prophet, if you will, in this moment, is to call our country to repentance and to a collective commitment to really address the slaughter of innocents in our country and in our communities every single day.
Has it been challenging to ensure a peaceful response?
Several days before the verdict came down, a lot of us were starting to hear the high level of frustration and angst and outrage at an impending outcome that many folks were dreading. So a lot of us were actually on the calls before the verdict came down. We all tried to get ahead of the story because we felt like if we were able to channel and create a framework whereby people can express their outrage, then it does minimize the kind of spontaneous and overwhelming rage that people may tend to express. I do think it is somewhat hypocritical for our country and for people, though, to be too quick to, you know, wonder why acts of violence may occur when people are outraged. I think we are a nation that has a very profound record of violence. And so I think that because we are all Americans and we all drink from the same water, you know, all of us have great potential to respond in ways that we think our faith teaches us not to respond. And this is why I think the role of the faith community is to remind us of our values, to not be ignorant of the ways in which this story of America has shaped us, and to also call ourselves to a very higher calling.
Pastor Mike, there is a deep us versus them divide in our country that's been reinforced in our minds by this case. So many Americans simply didn't believe all along that justice was available to Trayvon Martin.
I think that we as a country are wanting to move too fast to get beyond race because we have not yet adequately dealt with race. The reality is, most all of our disparities in our country of health, of economics, of opportunities are all very pronounced based on race, that you can have the same education in this country, you can have the same qualifications in this country, and all the research tells us that if you are of a certain skin color, particularly black, if you are an immigrant, then you will not have the same results in your career, in the kind of money you make, in the kind of opportunities afforded to you. Ignoring all of these kind of conditions that are in front of our face really exacerbates the kind of hopelessness and nihilism that really grips the heart of many people in this country. I think both black and white, and I think part of what, again, the faith community must be calling ourselves to do is embrace a very rigorous, constructive, and truth-telling discussion around race. So I do think that the impulse to just quickly move into this post-racial world, we are constantly being reminded almost every 6 months that the post-racial world is still a galaxy far away. And where we live and where we breathe and where we work and where we worship is a very racialized world. But that is good news. It's not bad news. If we have courage, if we have the theology, if we have the philosophy, if we have the humanity, if we have the compassion to step into this and embrace it for what it is and move towards a healing conversation. And this is the work I think that we plan to do with our campaign. Over the next 6 months, we plan to launch thousands upon thousands of conversations around race and faith and justice. And I think that's the challenge that our campaign, and I pray all of the listeners, will take up. And I think when we can do that, we'll see, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, a country that is filled with people who can be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin.
The Reverend Mike McBride is director of the PICO National Network's Lifelines to Healing campaign. I think you'll benefit from reading his recent Huffington Post article on the Trayvon Martin case, headlined, "It's Not the Verdict, It's Our Values." Pastor Mike, you're in the right job. Thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend. Look forward to talking with you soon.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Reza Eslan is a respected religion scholar, a popular commentator, best-selling author, and university professor. His first book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, has been translated into 13 languages and named one of the 100 most important books of the last decade. This week, Random House released his latest, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Dr. Eslan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
You know, I was remembering today, looking forward to this interview, I recall vividly when we talked about No God But God, and you've written another great book in the fundamentalism book and How You Win a Cosmic War. I can't quite figure out the sequence. How did you get Jesus of Nazareth falling after those two?
Well, believe it or not, this Jesus book, Zealot, was the first book that I started working on. I've actually been working on this book, really, I would say, for about two decades, ever since my undergraduate degree in the New Testament. And I did a thesis then on something called the Messianic Secret in the Gospel of Mark, and that really began to turn some screws in my mind about examining not just the historical Jesus, but the world in which he lived and how that world impacted who he was, the things that he said, the decisions that he made, and ultimately his tragic end.
Yeah. Reza, are you putting Jesus in the zealot party, or are you just calling him a zealot?
Very good question. Yes. So there is something called the zealot party that arises in the year 66 CE. That's the year in which the Jews rise up against the Roman Empire, manage miraculously to throw the Romans out of the Holy Land, and then keep them at bay for about three and a half years until the year 70 CE, when the Romans return under General Titus and end up destroying Jerusalem, burning it to the ground, raising the temple of God, defiling its ashes, murdering some 100,000 Jews who had holed themselves up in the walls of Jerusalem, and then scattering the survivors out of the Holy Land for the next well, about 2,000 years, actually. But the Zealot Party did not arise out of nowhere. They formed out of this sentiment that had been a part of the general apocalyptic fervor of first century Palestine for most of the century. Zealotism was less a political affiliation than it was a mode of activism, a spirituality, a sense of devout nationalism that called for an end to the Roman occupation, a liberation of the Jews from heathen control, and an establishment of God's rule over the Holy Land. And the argument that I make in the book is that if you look at Jesus' words and actions within the historical context of the time in which he lived, he most definitely shared those sentiments of zealotism that were so widespread in his time.
Would you argue that the zealotism of Jesus was one of the reasons that the people around him were very reticent to recognize him as the Messiah?
Excellent point. Yes, that's right. And that's where this concept of the messianic secret comes from. You have to understand that in first century Palestine, simply saying the words, "I am the Messiah," is a treasonable offense, punishable by crucifixion. The Messiah means the anointed one. According to the Jews, the whole purpose of the Messiah was to, as the descendant of King David, was to reestablish the kingdom of David on earth, to recreate the kingdom of God, to establish the reign of God as the sole sovereign over the Holy Land. Well, there's a problem with that sentiment because there is already a sovereign over the Holy Land in first century Palestine. It's Caesar Augustus. This is all Roman military occupation territory. And so for someone to say that I am the Messiah and that God's reign is about to be fulfilled is tantamount to saying the reign of Caesar is about to come to an end. And so Jesus was not the only person with these zealot tendencies who claimed to be the Messiah, who was ultimately crucified as a state criminal. There were, as a matter of fact, some dozen or so other messiahs who lived just before and just after Jesus who made similar claims and who faced a similar end as Jesus did.
I want to jump forward now from first century to right now. Reza, you were raised Muslim, converted to evangelical Christianity for a time, and then returned to Islam. How do you think your unique perspective is helpful in writing this book? Because I think it's valuable.
That's a very good question. Yes, when I was 15 years old, I heard the gospel story for the very first time and wholeheartedly accepted it, accepted Jesus into my heart, and actually began about a 4 or 5 year process as a missionary. I went around the country preaching the gospel, trying to convert everyone that I met into this belief that I had. When I entered college and began to study the New Testament in an academic environment, however, I began to notice a bit of a chasm between what I was learning about the historical Jesus and the world in which he lived and the way that Jesus had been presented to me in the evangelical church that I was going to. And what was kind of strange to me, almost ironic in a sense, is that the more I learned about the historical Jesus, the more I was drawn to him. In fact, I became, as I often say, a far more devoted follower of Jesus of Nazareth than I think I really ever was of Jesus the Christ, this man who lived 2,000 years ago, who dared defy the greatest empire the world had ever known and lost, but who in the process presented a path for social justice, the protection of the poor and the weak, the speaking truth to power, whether it be the political power, Rome in his case, or the religious power, the temple priests, is something that was profoundly activating in me. And to this day, even when I sort of returned to my Muslim roots, I still see myself as following in the footsteps that in my interpretation were blazed by Jesus as this unique and extraordinary man who really shaped who I am as an individual.
Would you lean toward Nietzsche, who said the last Christian died on the cross?
Well, I would actually change it around, and I would not call Jesus a Christian. Now, this is, I think, a more philosophical slash theological viewpoint that I talk about a lot in my books. But we have to remember that prophets are not inventors of religion. Jesus didn't invent Christianity. Moses didn't invent Judaism. Siddhartha Gautama did not invent Buddhism. Muhammad did not invent Islam. Prophets are reformers. Their task is to take the religious and social and political milieu in which they live and to reform it, to recast it, to renew it. In a sense, it's often the case that it's left to the followers of the prophet after the prophet has died to then take this Herculean task of taking the words and the actions of the prophet that they knew and formulating it into an institution, creating a religion out of it, which is frankly why we often are met with this uncomfortable reality that there is often so much of a difference between the values that are preached by the prophet and those that are espoused by the institutions that arose from the teachings of the prophet. I think a lot of Christians would say that there is a difference between the Christian church or the Catholic church and the values preached by Jesus. I know a lot of Muslims, myself included, would say that there is a huge difference between Islam in the way that it's treated by so many Muslims today and the values preached by the Prophet Muhammad himself.
What were the surprises in your research, or did you have any?
There were two surprises, actually. Very good question. The first surprise, as I sort of mentioned briefly before, is just how many other people there were in first century Palestine who called themselves Messiah, who gathered followers to them, who healed the sick and the lame, who exorcised demons, who called for the kingdom of God. And who were ultimately arrested and executed for their words. In a sense, many of these people, we know their names. Some of them are actually mentioned in the New Testament. A few of them actually had more followers than Jesus did in their lifetime. Many were even more famous and more well-known than Jesus was in their lifetime. That's the first surprise. The second surprise is linked to that, which is that out of those dozen or so people who claimed to be the Messiah, only one of them is still called Messiah, and that's Jesus of Nazareth. And my question, and the question that I try to tackle in the book, is why? Why is it that out of all of those, Jesus, who actually when compared to these other figures was in his lifetime not nearly as successful and not nearly as significant, why is Jesus the one that we still call Messiah? And to me, the answer lies in what happened after Jesus's death. Obviously, the resurrection is a very difficult topic for historians to talk about. It is the quintessential expression of faith in the Christian world. But regardless of whether you believe in the resurrection or not, what you cannot deny is what I refer to as the resurrection experience. The fact that the followers of Jesus said that they experienced something miraculous and extraordinary. And again, even if you don't believe in what they experienced, you can't deny that that experience resulted in these followers not doing what the followers of all the other messiahs who were killed did, which is to just simply go home and abandon the movement. But these followers decided to keep going. They decided to continue preaching Jesus, despite the fact that, you know, according to Jewish tradition, his death as a common criminal annulled his messianic claims. After all, what the Jews were awaiting was a Messiah who would recreate the kingdom of David on earth. Jesus didn't do that. And so by the definition of the Hebrew Bible, he was no longer the Messiah. And yet his followers refused to acknowledge that, and they kept going. And perhaps the biggest reason not to just simply dismiss their experiences out of hand, whether you're a believer or not, is the fact that 2,000 years later, this is the largest religion in the world.
Reza Aslan is the author of the international bestseller No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, as well as of Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in a Globalized Age. His brand new book is titled Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, just out from Random House. Dr. Aslan, I really appreciate you giving us so much time on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week, please. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about this show. We want this to be a nationwide conversation. Encourage your friends to listen so they can join us in this dialogue. And join us again next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.